My name's Catherine Gunn, and I was working at GCHQ as a Chinese Mandarin linguist and analyst. And I blew the whistle on the Iraq War, UN spying scandal, but I also grew up in Taiwan. That's how I became a bilingual kid. And so I have, you know, interest in China-Taiwan issues.
So what was your family doing in Taiwan in the first place? Because this is, it's interesting, because it's a result of the Civil War, really, which pretty much ended not long after the Second World War, where a faction of the Chinese were sort of isolated on this island off the coast of China. And so that rather than come to a sort of a conclusion like, say, the English Civil War did in China, it's almost as if, say, I don't know, Cromwell or the king had ended up on the Isle of Wight and set up a separate country. So can you just tell us a bit about, you know, growing up in Taiwan and how come your family was there?
Well, my dad studied as a mature student. He studied Chinese because he'd always wanted to, even as a young, as a teenager and growing up in Yorkshire, he'd, you know, approached his grammar school head a grammar school tutor to say that he was interested in classical Chinese and also in Persian, and he wanted to, you know, what was the future possibility of studying or working. And they said, oh, don't bother with that, son, you know, what's the point in doing that? You'd be better off doing modern languages. So he ended up doing modern languages at uni, even though he actually had more interest in Chinese. And so eventually, after he worked for a little while as a French teacher at a grammar school and decided he couldn't face that anymore, he was able to study Chinese at university, again, as a mature student. And back then, in the 70s, they didn't have a year abroad because China was not as stable as they would have liked. So after he completed his studies, he decided that he would like to experience living in Asia. And so he found a job teaching at a university in Taiwan. And that's why we moved there in 1977.
Do you want to just say something about the sort of political differences, maybe a bit about the history, the separation of Taiwan and China?
Well, I mean, it's quite a long-winded sort of history. And, you know, Taiwan has a very small island with a very mountainous central region that runs down the length of the island. It only has a sort of very small amount of fertile arable land on the China-facing side, on the western side of the island. It's sort of shaped like a banana leaf. And basically, historically, it's had a sort of similar types of indigenous people that you find throughout Southeast Asia in places like Indonesia and other places like that. They all, you know, that they live in those sorts of semi-tropical environments throughout Southeast Asia. And also going back over 300 years, the coastal parts of China facing Taiwan, so places like Fujian and Guangzhou, the sort of farmers and various other people probably over previous 300 years had decided to evade the sort of imperial system in China, presumably just because they wanted to not have to pay tax and all this sort of stuff. So they migrated to Taiwan and were virtually sort of, you know, they weren't really centrally managed by China. You know, China didn't really have much control over the island of Taiwan, but it was nominally sort of within their sphere of influence. But then there was various occupations by the Portuguese, by the Dutch, and then by the Japanese following the loss of the war between China and Japan. That was one of the concessions that Japan had over Taiwan for 50 years. And coming right up to the end of the Second World War, and because Japan was on the wrong side of the war in the Second World War, they ended up losing Taiwan as part of being the in the side that lost the war. And so Taiwan was sort of essentially on its own between 1945 and 1949. And then after the end of the Chinese civil war between the nationalists, who were essentially funded by America, more or less, and the communists, when the communists established control over the whole of China, the nationalists fled, about 2 million of them, with a hoard of wealth and national treasures, and fled onto the island of Taiwan and basically set up an sort of emergency government, military emergency government, with an iron grip over the people who'd been living there more or less peacefully, well, except for the Japanese occupation, for the, you know, for generations and generations. And it was a one-party state, basically, of KMT rule, nationalist rule, until about late 1990s, when the first proper sort of election, so-called two-party state, two-party election took place.
Now, the reason we're talking about this part of the world is because of threats, apparently, from China to Britain's electoral process. Now, we heard this quite a lot of this last time, including Brexit and the Trump elections from Russia. Now, apparently, China, too, is joining this club of cyber attackers. So what do you make of this? When I hear it on the news here, I think, well, I remember reading, gosh, must have been around about 2015, maybe, at the Vault 7 release by WikiLeaks. It may have been actually 16 or 17 even, it was now possible to make any cyber attack look as if it was coming from any part of the world. And yet this seems to have been all forgotten. And this is China has now apparently hacked its way into Britain's electoral databases. So I don't know quite how that enables them to fix elections. But anyway, there is extreme concern this week that the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese government, is able to manipulate British elections.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, they haven't shown any evidence. You know, they allege these things. So, you know, without seeing the actual evidence and without having real unbiased investigations into these claims, you know, we just have to take it at their word. And, you know, we have years, decades of experience now of, you know, our intelligence services lying essentially about all sorts of things. And in fact, you know, again, if you look at history and all the coups and all the election interference and all the outright wars just to depose leaders and so on around the world, that the US, well, the Anglo-American empire has been involved in since the 19, well, I mean, if you include South America. You could go back to the 1800s, but certainly since the early 1900s, in the 1940s and 50s and so on. I mean, it's sort of, it's incredible, isn't it, that the history of Anglo-American interference in other people's democratically or however you want to define it, elections and governments and so on, that just is never discussed. You know, it's just that just is ignored by all, most everyone. And then they churn out these stories year after year recently about Russian interference, which there was no evidence of it when they finally did expose everything. There was no, all of those cozy bears and God knows what bears that they were accusing of, you know, there was no real evidence of how that interference actually changed anything for Russia. What did it change? How did it benefit Russia in any way if they had even interfered in Russian, in US politics? I mean, how has it benefited them? It hasn't, because, I mean, Russia has faced sanctions after sanctions after sanctions. Likewise, China. How, you know, what difference would it make if they interfered in US, UK elections? It would change nothing, really, because the UK is a uniparty, virtually a uniparty state. You know, there's hardly any distinction whatsoever in foreign policy between Labour and Tory. That's, you know, the first thing I would say about it.
So the top Chinese diplomat was hauled into the Foreign Office this week on Tuesday after the British government called the cyber attack on the Electoral Commission and parliamentarians called it out. China's charge d'affaires in London was summoned for a formal dressing down a day after Britain announced limited sanctions against two Chinese individuals and a company over past hacking. The ambassador, Zeng Ziwang, apparently is out of the UK. So, you know, you've got something very peculiar going on here, really. That is to say, we're trying to court China investing in things like nuclear power stations, the building of those here at Hinkley Point, just down the road from us in Bristol, and at the same time accusing them without evidence of trying to control our elections. What do you think is the bigger picture in UK-China relations? It seems a bit schizophrenic.
It does. I mean, I think, personally, I think part of this whole narrative, it is to make the British public sort of believe that their elections are otherwise free and fair if it weren't for these so-called foreign interference by, you know, unsympathetic or hostile nations. Now, they don't, there's one nation that they never discuss in terms of interference in British political spheres of life. And, you know, that's Israel. So the irony is that I think you mentioned it in probably on your shows before, you know, the Alan Duncan diaries that came out in 2021, where he openly names Israel as being, you know, with the deepest fingers in British political spheres. And, you know, there's been no investigation of that. I mean, he has more probably laid out in more open terms than these allegations of Israeli influence in British politics. So I think as I was saying, I think part of this is to make the British public believe that the elections in the UK are always free and fair. And I think this is, you know, this is a lie, because we can see from 2015 to 2020 when the UK establishment went after Corbyn. You know, for the first time in, well, probably in most of our living memories, a politician became a potential candidate to lead Britain, who most would say was the only truly anti-establishment figure. You know, and the whole establishment, including his own party, went after him. Now, that in itself is a clear example of interfering in British political, in the whole British government and the systems of government. But nobody, no one accuses anybody of that. Nobody's.
Just to be fair, there was a small political meeting in Bristol where there was a lot of talk about this. This is about the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, where we were in the meeting, we're looking at the affiliations of the various Labour MPs in Bristol, of which there's now four. Karen Smith, Thangam Debonair, actually five. Karen Smith, Thangam Debonair, and Darren Jones are all Labour friends of Israel. Kerry McCarthy is not, but the new MP for Kingswood, who's now a Labour MP, it was Conservative in a by-election, is actually married, if you can call it that. His partner in marriage is a man who worked for 6 years for Unit 8200, which is Israeli intelligence. So there was a bit of a discussion last night where people were saying, well, actually, it looks as if Bristol is, basically it's Israel friendly during a genocide. Now, the UN has just today been announcing that they do believe it's a genocide there. So this is almost, I think I'm just trying to illustrate how in the bigger picture in the London press, this isn't really acknowledged, but it is on a more local level here in Britain. And I don't know if anybody really ever thinks or talks much about China.
Right. I mean, so this is where the reality on the ground is at such odds with the status quo, the establishment. You know, it goes with, as you say, this, I mean, it was in The Guardian a couple of months ago, an article about Israeli lobby backing congressional members in the US and how that support allows the US Congress to consistently vote in support of Israel instead of what the grassroots, the vast majority of American people probably are also wanting ceasefire. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just as another little point of clarification, the Chinese are very much supportive of the Palestinian cause. They haven't sent the military in. So it seems to me you're saying that actually that the world is kind of dividing into, well, this is a fascinating conflict, horrific, but fascinating, going on in Gaza, because it seems to be almost kind of dividing the whole world.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a split. And I think the Anglo-American sphere of influence is limited to the Five Eyes and their sort of quisling followers like Japan and South Korea and so on. I mean, they've just got the usual suspects, but they're a dwindling minority in terms of population size and in terms of, you know, economic output as well, I would argue. The divide is very clear in the UN and in the General Assemblies and the various voting blocks and so on. But it's also reflective in domestic in our own country. So it's, we're very divided in our own countries as well, you know, with the vast majority of people seeing this horrific, these horrific scenes on social media and so on, and in the news about what's actually happening in Gaza and in the West Bank. And nobody wants this. Nobody, you know, it's galling. It's galling to see. It's a horrible reality to be living in a world where it's happening real time, and you know, you feel impotent. And this anger will be, and this feeling of not being, sort of the government not reflecting the public mood is going to be exacerbated. And it's, you know, it's already at the sort of trust in the government, trust in the media is at all time lows, and it will continue to fall as long as they don't reflect the public mood. And you know, but the government continues to establish laws and regulations which, rather than allow the public to be able to voice their frustration and, you know, and put forward alternative views, it's actually shutting down these types of activities within the public sphere, you know. So it's a very dangerous, I feel like it's sort of a 1930s type of atmosphere again in the Anglo-American sphere.
Well, I suppose back in the 30s, there were quite a lot of people who were saying, oh, Hitler's doing a great job. You know, he's keeping the Soviets away, the Bolsheviks away. And that there was a lot of tension in Britain. In fact, I can remember reading about the founder of the BBC, Lord Reith, being absolutely adamant that, you know, Hitler was doing a good thing and keeping voices off the airwaves, like actually as he was Winston Churchill in the 1930s, was warning about Hitler and saying, look, you know, we're going to have to deal with this guy. It seems there's almost a bit of a parallel going on with Israel.
Right. So, I mean, of course, there are people, you know, the sort of Christian Zionists and various far-right elements who are still trying to retain some sort of moral high ground, although that, I mean, they can't, there is no, they can't hold on, there is, there's, so there's this real internal conflict where and in order to, the problem with people who are still trying to maintain the moral high ground in the face of the absolute opposite is that they just get more defensive and more violent and more angry. So I think we see this with the ratcheting up of rhetoric. And
yeah, I mean, like, for example, we've had Ben Kavir, I think it was on Tuesday this week, saying that the United Nations, maybe on Monday, that the United Nations was itself anti-Semitic. And people are kind of shrugging their shoulders as if to say, well, that's just nonsense. And, you know, you are this whole idea of accusing people of anti-Semitism, i.e. being pro-Nazi, with the legacy of World War II and the Holocaust, has sort of run its course completely. But look, your real expertise is within GCHQ, signals intelligence, and I wonder what role you think that is playing at the moment and what people like GCHQ are actually up to, because surely it's their job to stop these cyber attacks by China. Maybe they can't stop them, or maybe they're doing other things with their time and all the money that we give them. So what do you make of the role of the signals intelligence and maybe other sorts of intelligence in all of this conflict that's slowly splitting the world?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's, you know, the sort of war has become you know, it's no longer conventional warfare. It's hybrid warfare, as they call it now. And so it's, you know, in this kind of situation, nobody really knows who's doing what, right? I mean, that's the whole sort of, that's the result of hybrid war. And I think our, in the, I keep referring to the Anglo-American, but basically it is, it's the US, UK sort of former empires, and they're collapsing. I mean, I think it's fairly evident that, you know, the British-American sort of 100-year rule has well, is in the British sphere, it's gone on for longer, but it's coming to an end. And they can't fight a conventional war anymore. This is the problem. You know, they're being on the battlefield. They are defeated by Russia's hypersonic missile capabilities at the top end of technology, but at the lower end of technology, they're beaten by the Ansar Allah, you know, Yemeni low-tech version of conventional warfare, you know, where the drones, fairly low-tech drones, are able to completely block, you know, trade routes and sink ships and so on. So the only real kind of warfare they have is this hybrid warfare that they're almost the experts at, I would say. I don't think, I would argue that China and Russia are not, they haven't developed the hybrid warfare to the extent that US, UK and Israel have developed it. The sort of psychological warfare angle, the yeah, the hybrid warfare side of things has been the key element of the US and UK deep state, you know, all the CIA type activities and MI5 and MI6 activities, Mossad activities that have gone on for decades can be described as hybrid warfare. And, you know, GCHQ is part and parcel of that, NSA obviously as well. And because they're paid by the state, you know, they get their funding from the state, they have to constantly justify their existence. And without an external threat, they, you know, their funding would drop, you know, because if they don't constantly churn out reports claiming that, oh, they've detected this and there's that going on, and oh, you know, without that threat level, they lose the funding levels. And you know, to some extent, there may be intellectual and economic espionage, but the U.S. put out, the Pentagon put out a document that was over 190 pages. It came out in, I think, 2021. And basically, the whole, you know, U.S. Defense agencies could not detect or did not elaborate in this nearly 200-page document anything to do with election interference from China at all. There was but no reference to it, no reference to that sort of activity. There were references, very vague, very sort of alleged, on economic espionage and intellectual property espionage. But that was really it. So, you know, all of this is just hype. It's all just theater.
What about if people are interested in following what you do, Catherine, do you have a blog? Everyone seems to have a Substack nowadays, but you're on social media?
Yeah, you know, I don't have a Substack because, like you say, everyone has a Substack. I'm not on social media really that much apart from Telegram. I've given up Facebook more or less. It's, you know, and you know, as everybody should know, the biggest hacks or data leaks or whatever, the biggest gathering of our data is not the Communist Party of China. It's all these large US mega companies like, you know, Meta, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple and Microsoft and so on, all massive US firms. And they, you know, we all use their products, inevitably, most of us. And they're constantly hoovering up our data 24/7. Every single day of the year. Why is that not the top issue in terms of US influence and the world in terms of the amount of information they have on everybody around the world?
Yes, it's funny that, isn't it? It's almost as if there's again a bit more schizophrenia going on there. With we're ignoring the elephant in the room. Anyway, I think we have to say something a bit positive. This is very dreary news. Our government is totally lying to us. Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel? Something positive, or even if it's just if you want to talk about changes that you think that are being ignored that would actually make a genuine difference and make, you know, improve people's lives rather than sending us all into bouts of depression if we take it too seriously?
Well, I think the art is to not take it seriously. I mean, as you say at the beginning of your show, is to turn off the psycho in the corner. I think that's absolutely right. You know, it's basically, I can't listen to the news and take it seriously. It really makes my, I cringe and grate. And, but you know, it's talking to people in the local environment, you know, talking whoever you come into contact with, if you can get into a conversation with them, and just try and help them see, if they don't already, and I think a lot of people do, that, you know, the mainstream narratives are just falling apart, and they, you know, they're mostly all just fabrications.
I think there's this big sense of angst out there. I mean, this is one of the things I detect, certainly here in Bristol, that people know something's wrong. They're not quite sure what it is, but they know it's something's very wrong.
Yeah, well, it's pretty galling, you know, to see the infrastructure collapse in the UK as it has done in the US. I mean, the US national infrastructure is just abysmal. It's completely collapsing in the US because they have, because of the neo-colonial, the sort of neoliberal free market, so-called free market. You know, as you often discuss on your show, Tony, it's destroying the fabric of the infrastructure of these countries. It, you know, the US has not had seen investment since the 60s and the 70s, likewise in the UK. And instead of councils talking about how they're going to implement net zero type policies in their local communities, you know, we need, it seems the only way, and this is what a few people are now really focusing on, is to get voted into your local council. If you can get into your local councils and start trying to influence and implement changes that are actually beneficial to the local community, instead of these net zero policies, that all they're going to do ultimately is to impoverish and, you know, reduce the sort of living standards of the people in your community. I think that that's where change might have some actual benefit, is in the local community, because, you know, we can see that the uniparty system just doesn't work for anybody in the UK.
Yeah, okay. And also, I mean, we've got this week a report from Cambridge where they completely blocked this idea of bringing in a congestion clean air zone thing, simply by getting the first Tory elected onto Cambridge City Council for the first time for as long as anyone can remember, because of the resistance against the this charging zone. So it seems to me that, you know, we're going back to almost like pre-Civil War days here in Britain, where there were massive objections to these tolls across the country, where people couldn't get anywhere without paying vast amounts of money. So they're going to do the same with clean air zones in our cars, even though they're really nothing. I mean, certainly here in Bristol, and I've heard also in London, it's nothing really to do with clean air, because air is getting cleaner anyway. So the environment is being used as sort of a big excuse. Anyway, look, sorry, that's me ranting on. Catherine, it's fascinating to hear your take on all these things, as ever. So thanks very much for joining us again.
Okay, thanks, Tony. Catch up with you again soon.